The Queen's Jewish Link presents the Jewish Living Podcast, the show that examines the many facets of Orthodox Jewish life. Here's your host, Izzo Zwirin.
One of the biggest issues affecting the day-to-day lives of Jews in America is personal and community safety. History is replete with Jews being victimized, but unfortunately, we don't have to look that far back to understand that the threat is still present. From Poway to Pittsburgh, from Muncie to Jersey City, and many, many others that continue to happen, we all know the danger is ever present. But instead of simply highlighting the issue, we thought it would be a better use of our time to see how we can proactively improve our situation. That's why we invited on this week's guest.
So my name is Richard Priem. I'm the Deputy National Director for the Community Security Service, or the CSS, a 501c3 dedicated to training Jewish volunteers to help protect their institutions and events.
Richard will explain the history of the CSS, as well as what we can do individually as part of a shul and as a community to fight back against the violence. Richard, thank you so much for joining me this week. I truly appreciate it. I've been trying to get some volunteer from the CSS or an employee from the CSS on for a while, as you know, and I'm very glad that we could make this work. Can you give me a little bit of a background about yourself? And then we'll get into what CSS does and how people can get involved.
Sure. So as you can probably hear from my accent, I wasn't born in the United States. I grew up in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. My grandparents were Holocaust survivors. And when we saw rising levels of anti-Semitism across Europe when I was growing up, it was a very logical step for me that when I turned 18, I became involved with the security of the Jewish community in the Netherlands. I started off as a volunteer and ended up moving to Israel and doing graduate studies in the United States and working in a variety of security roles around the world, all to come back to New York in 2015 to work on counterterrorism for the United Nations Security Council. And as I was working there for a few years, assessing the counterterrorism capacities of different countries around the world and writing reports about, you know, trends in terrorist threats and so forth, Pittsburgh happened. And, coming from a Jewish background and having been involved with the security of my community in the Netherlands, always thinking that in the United States and Israel, people wouldn't have to worry about anti-Semitism in Israel because there's a Jewish majority, and in the United States because, well, I thought you guys had that under control. And Pittsburgh happened, and I realized it was not the case. And I was thinking, why am I, you know, working on counterterrorism around the world when, you know, right here where I live, and by the time I was married to my wife, who's an American, right here where I live, there's this threat against the Jewish community, and I have these skills, I have this background, why don't I put it to good use? So I left the United Nations and joined the Anti-Defamation League. I was their New York director for international affairs. And based in New York, I was there at Jersey City. I was there the day after Muncie. And, I was tired of talking about anti-Semitism. I wanted to do something about it. So when the former vice president of the Anti-Defamation League became the CEO of the CSS, I joined him and became his deputy. And I basically run all programs and operations. And if people wonder, what is the CSS? What is it exactly that we do? We are, a non-for-profit that was established in 2007 by members of the community with a military or law enforcement background that were concerned at the time that there didn't seem to be a whole lot of security around Jewish institutions and events. And they've been for almost a decade. They were mostly in the New York area, but they did expand to have a presence nationally, but without a lot of resources, without a lot of professional staff. We're trying to do the same kind of training for volunteers that I grew up with in the Netherlands and that you have around the world in Jewish communities, where for a myriad of reasons, volunteers tend to be the linchpin of security of the Jewish community. They try to bring that training here to the US. And like I said, after Pittsburgh, a number of big family foundations and supporters came together and decided that this volunteer security layer was necessary, and they invested in the CSS and allowed us to really scale. And we've now been growing rapidly. We've rolled out a number of new programs. We've also become more public facing, do more press and so forth, because we really believe that the clock is ticking and we need to add this layer of basic security awareness of empowering communities to take part in their own security to as many synagogue, Jewish schools and community members as possible.
So how many communities are you in right now? And is it only in the United States or is it elsewhere as well?
We are a US-based organization, but our model and the things that we train in are fine-tuned and developed by experiences by Jewish communities around the world. So if you've ever been to Europe and you went to a synagogue there, you probably were questioned at the entrance by people who were wondering who you were and why you came to visit that synagogue. And those were volunteers. If you go to Latin America, the same thing. Actually, the United States is the only country where it has not been a mainstream presence, volunteer security. And I think part of that is because things were good here, but also has to do with a different culture, different mentality. But I think that is changing. And I think people are seeing the rising levels of anti-Semitism and are more concerned and they want to have a bigger role in their own security. So that probably explains why we're getting more and more demand for our program. So to answer your question, there's two things I want to answer your question with. One is we're right now in around 15 regions from coast to coast. We have active teams of volunteers at over 125 synagogues. We have other programs for another few dozen synagogues, and we've trained altogether over 5,000 people, even though not everyone is still active. We're getting new requests from synagogues, from schools, from other centers, and from individuals on a daily basis. And we've developed a number of programs so that we can cater really to all sorts of demands. Some people who just want to train their congregation in basic security awareness, we have this entry point program, which is a 1-hour virtual program that we deliver online, and we go into the basics of volunteer security, but also what they can do as community members to, common sense things they can do to help to keep their community safe, all the way to our CSS synagogue program, where we really put people through advanced training in order to be able to be a team and help protect their institution. We have a third program too, I'm sure we can talk about it later. It's called Rome. It's for the more younger unaffiliated who want to help protect their community but are not necessarily connected to a synagogue. And they do a lot of event security and so forth. But I quickly wanted to refer back to is the first part of your question about whether this is only in the US or internationally. And I think the reason why volunteer security became so dominant in the way Jewish communities around the world protect themselves is for three reasons. One, in many parts of the world, Jews couldn't always rely on government to protect them. And I'm not just talking about Eastern Europe or Latin America or even North Africa, where there was a presence of a volunteer security group in Morocco. But even in a country like France, where in the 80s, you had a terrorist attack on a synagogue. And nobody in the synagogue got hurt, but two bystanders got killed. And the French Minister of Justice went on television and said at the time, today there was an attack targeting the Jews in the synagogue, but instead killing two innocent Frenchmen, somehow suggesting that those Jews inside the synagogue were not innocent Frenchmen, but were somehow legitimate targets because they were Jewish. So one of the core reasons why this volunteer security became so prominent around the world is because in many countries, Jews were very much reliant on themselves to protect themselves. So that's one of the reasons. Another reason is ideological. Like I grew up in the Netherlands, my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. And not many people know this, but in the Netherlands they didn't have a military occupation, they had an administrative occupation by the Germans. So Dutch police was working under German rule. So it were, even though, of course, the Germans were responsible, but it was Dutch police that picked people up from their homes. It was Dutch train conductors that drove trains from Amsterdam to the transit camps from where they would go to concentration camps further east. And so to have, a country like the Netherlands with a big part of the Jewish community being either Holocaust survivors or descendants of Holocaust survivors, having law enforcement standing at the door questioning people whether they belong or do not belong in a synagogue was not necessarily well received. And that is something that is in other parts of Europe played a part as well. So that ideological component is a second reason. And the third, and this really applies most to why we're growing so fast in the United States, is that there is a value add of having community members being trained in security. I mean, if it's your family and friends that are inside, you're going to be paying attention. That is not something that you can pay for. And the second thing is, if you're a member of that synagogue, if you're a member of the community, there are things that you're going to be able to identify as being suspicious, as being out of place, that someone who is not a member of that community is not familiar with. And I'm sure we can talk about some examples later on, but I think those are the three reasons why volunteer security has become the primary way of Jewish communities protecting themselves around the world. And that added value that volunteers bring to the table on an actual security level is why we're now getting some traction in the United States.
So you mentioned a lot of things, a lot that you mentioned that we need to unpack, but I want to go through a little bit more, you know, just take a couple of things at a time. Firstly, you mentioned that there's stuff that local police or local law enforcement can't do or doesn't do, depending on which neighborhood or state or country you might live in. But do you work with local law enforcement to provide them with information, to know the community at large, things like that?
Absolutely. And I think when I talk about that communities can't always rely on the government to protect them, we're mainly talking about places outside the United States, historically, not in the United States. But yes, we at CSS have a very good relationship with law enforcement. We have a security advisory council where we have former FBI, former Homeland Security, former Secret Service that help us with our programming and our training. But even operationally, like we have on a weekly basis, we have contact with law enforcement. When something happens that our teams report, we share it with law enforcement. And in no way do we think that CSS is a substitute for law enforcement or even private security. We think that, you know, law enforcement is obviously the most important security layer for any community, including the Jewish community in the United States. Private security, for those who can afford it, it's great. It adds a key security layer to that institution. But volunteers is an additional layer. It's, you know, when you go swimming with your son and you go to the swimming pool, it's great that there's a lifeguard on duty, but you're still going to be paying attention, right? And that's the additional layer that volunteer security bring to the table.
All right, and when you're talking about volunteer security, what type of things are you training for these volunteer security? Like, they're not going to be trained in some of the tactics that your security council might be trained in, and you yourself included. But these are volunteers that are standing out there in front of a synagogue, in front of a park or whatever, and their job is to really be the first line. So what training are they going through? Without going into specifics, I don't want the bad guys to hear this.
But that was going to be my answer. Like, even in some of the things you just said, if we would be, you know, accurate, you know, it's not completely accurate how you described where volunteers would be standing and what do they do. So I can obviously not disclose exactly what we train our volunteers in, but I will say that we have a myriad of programs that go from very basic, just raising basic security awareness of congregants, all the way to advanced training that does become best in class training that I think is very professional and bring security to a very high level. But even though I can't disclose sort of, you know, we train them in these tactics, our goal is to prevent and disrupt attacks. And, you know, if an attack does take place, God forbid, to some extent, security, and I'm not just talking about our security, but also law enforcement, intelligence, et cetera, failed, right? You would like to detect someone radicalizing before the person buys the weapons and goes to the synagogue or the church or wherever he or she wants to perpetrate an attack. And our security routines are geared towards that as well. You know, we're proactive and we're outward facing and all our training is geared to trying to stop an attack as early as possible and as far away as possible from the people we are protecting. So obviously, you know, that's about as much detail I can give, but I would add to that that, you know, we have a variety of programs from very basic, you know, security awareness programs all the way to advanced training that, you know, that I do not think is less than some of the private security companies train their staff in. And these are routines and skills that have been developed over decades of experience, not only by us, but also by communities around the world. And we're continuously updating our routines and our training based on the realities we're facing.
All right, so let's move on to some of the programs that you mentioned. I'm going to name them. You already spoke a little bit about about two of them. And if you could talk a little bit about these programs. So you have the Entry Point that you spoke about, Rome that you referenced, and then there's also something called the Interfaith Security Council. So you could talk about any or all of those things. I just want to hear a little bit about what those things are.
Okay. So entry point is a 1 hour training delivered virtually or in person. Can be done for a synagogue, can be done for another type of Jewish institution, can be done for a multitude of institutions. And there's a few key learnings that we try to focus on. We want the participants to be able to be partners. We want them to understand that they actually have a responsibility as members of the community to pay attention. I don't want to go too much into the, you know, what are the things that we teach them to pay attention to are, right. Because, you know, as you said, you have a very large audience and who knows who's listening in.
Exactly.
So that's one part of it. And there's also some common sense, basically, you know, what are some good and bad practices of security around your institution or building or event. And I think that the overarching learning from that entry point program is that we teach participants that security is not something that they cannot contribute to. They, whether they are young, old, religious, observant or not observant, and more culturally involved, everyone can contribute to their community security if they have been taught some basic things to pay attention to. And that's really what that entry point program focuses on. And obviously, you know, we hope that people from entry point will do more. So, and there's two programs that we have. If it's a synagogue or school or an institution that want to set up their own team, we have a CSS synagogue program. And this is really where we put in all our resources and our different modules we make available to help members of the community form an active team to protect their institution. And this includes everything from our, you know, our law enforcement relations, our intelligence capacities, our partnerships with other organizations that have information that's useful to our operational security training. We make that available as part of that program. And we have certified trainers across the country that help us with that. And then the third program is Rome. And this is more, like I said, for the younger and unaffiliated members of the community who want to help, who want to protect the Jewish community, but don't necessarily belong to a formal institution yet themselves. And, you know, and we make all the same training as we do for CSS Synagogue, we make available to them.
Very cool. All right. So,
and you mentioned interface.
Yes. Sorry. I apologize. Yes.
So, our CEO is a former vice president of the Anti-Defamation League. And as such, he has a strong background in civil rights. And he basically realized, listen, you know, there are, of course, certain threats that are unique to the Jewish community, but there are also threats that are, you know, certain white supremacists, you know, they will want to hit any minority that they do not like. So it doesn't make sense to not have lines of communication, to not share some basic best practices. So our CEO, Evan Bernstein, took that initiative and created the first ever Interfaith Security Council in New York, and where we have members of all different faith communities represented. It's together with the Community Security Initiative, which is a UJA Federation security initiative that we have a close partnership with in New York. And they are co-founders together with Pastor Gil Monrose, who is a Brooklyn-based pastor and a member of what they call the God Squad or Clergy Council, I think in 67.
And he was a guest on our podcast last year.
So you know, and he's a great man, great person. Yeah. And so basically the three of them came together, Rabbi Bob Kaplan from the JCRC, Evan Bernstein from CSS, and Pastor Monrose from the God Squad. And they basically brought this whole group together who now meet regularly and they can speak out in unison if one community is targeted, but also can share some experience about how to best take use of, you know, government resources that are available or some common sense best practices. And we just started that a few months ago and it has been getting great traction. And it's not something that we dedicate a lot of, you know, it's not core to our mission. Like our mission is to protect Jewish life and Jewish way of life. But, you know, we don't want to work in a silo, and we want to be part of a larger community. We want to share and we want to help. And that's why Evan took that initiative.
Terrific. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on the different types of people that commit acts of anti-Semitism. We've spent enough episodes on that. What I do want to get to is different actual acts. So the first thing I want to talk about is everyday anti-Semitism versus mass casualties. Things like the differences between, you know, somebody spray painting a building versus driving a car down the street and yelling something at passing Jews walking by versus physical violence. And the difference, so how, basically, how should we treat physical violence versus vandalism versus shouting from a passing car?
So, well, I think, and you know, we should not accept any of it, right? Anti-Semitism is unacceptable. And we've seen near record levels now for multiple years, as recorded by the Anti-Defamation League, as pointed out by the FBI. Anti-Jewish incidents are happening. They're increasing. They're spiking when something happened, like what happened a few weeks ago with the conflict between Israel and Hamas. And it can, you know, it doesn't necessarily the severity of the incident doesn't necessarily correlate with the impact it can have on a community. And I'll give you an example. Like, we had this incident in Riverdale in the Bronx a few weeks ago, where our volunteers were actually heavily involved. Basically, a person started to vandalize the different Jewish synagogues in the area. And one time he came to one of the synagogues, and we had a volunteer team present who were able to, you know, identify him and provide information to the NYPD hate crimes unit that led to the to this person's arrest. But for a number of days, as this was going on, you know, and this person repeatedly came back, even when there was some police presence, and he came at night, he came at times when nobody was there vandalizing different buildings, it created a lot of concern in the community and a lot of fear. And people were saying, like, I don't feel comfortable going to synagogue when we don't know when this person will strike again, whether this is the beginning of a larger plan or is just going to stick to the vandalism, maybe he wants to burn something down, so forth. There's all this speculation. And obviously, we don't involve in that ourselves. This is just an observation of what was taking place in the community. And even though in hindsight, you can say, you know, it's just vandalism. It's not assault. It's not a mass shooting attack. But it severely disrupted Jewish life in that area. And then for us, as our mission is to protect Jewish life, but also Jewish way of life, you know, this incident, you know, even though in an ADL report, it will just be, you know, one of the 300 cases of vandalism that took place in the tri-state area. But for that community, for those weeks, it was a very, very serious event. And I'm glad that our teams were able to help NYPD in finding the perpetrator. You know, and there's, of course, you know, incidents that happen, like, you know, being harassed on the street, being verbally accosted or being assaulted. I mean, you know, we keep hearing these incidents happening in New York, in Brooklyn. You know, we've seen what was happening during the conflict in Gaza, where, you know, cars driving around the Diamond District, throwing firework at people, people being beaten up because they were wearing a yarmulke through, you know, and then these kind of incidents, you know, even when it is not necessarily leading to something that would be a crime, but they create fear in the community. Like, if one time a car convoy drove to a district and threw fireworks at Jewish passersby, then every time that there's rumors spreading that another car convoy is going to a Jewish neighborhood, is going to pass by a synagogue, people in that community are going to be concerned about it, and rightly so, because, you know, they've seen what happened in Los Angeles at the sushi restaurant, where one of those convoys stopped and people got out and asked diners who was Jewish and not, and started to attack them. We've seen what happened in the Diamond District. So even if 10 of those car convoys are peaceful or not resulting in any incidents, the fact that some of those incidents have already happened mean that it has a significant impact on the community. So I don't think it's as easy to differentiate, like, okay, well, vandalism is the least significant and harassment is more significant and assaults and mass shooting attacks are the worst. Obviously, the attacks like we've seen in Jersey City, in Poway, Pittsburgh, or Muncie that lead to the deaths of members of the community are of a different caliber. And I think, you know, for us as a security organization, those are, of course, on top of mind. But the sad reality is, and I've learned this myself, and I was standing in front of a synagogue in Amsterdam for years, you know, protecting mine, but also other synagogues around the country. A lot of things happen when you're standing in front of an identifiable Jewish building. And most of the time, you're not going to report it. Like, I'm not observant. I'm not walking around with a kippah. So I can, you know, when I leave the synagogue, nobody can necessarily recognize me as someone that is Jewish. But there are so many things happening that people are not even aware of, that are not being reported. And unfortunately, you know, buildings that are identifiably Jewish or people that are identifiably Jewish carry the brunt of those incidents. And sadly, most of them never make it into any reports. You know, whenever we talk about FBI statistics or ADL statistics, we're just talking about the tip of the iceberg. So happy to delve deeper into different kinds of incidents that we're seeing, but I don't think, with the exception of the mass shooting attacks and the terrorist attacks, I don't think you can automatically correlate the severity of an incident with the kind of this impact it has on disrupting community life.
So yeah, we'll get into some. So we could talk about gun violence versus vehicular violence. If there's a difference in how you react to things, and what most of my listeners aren't going to be, you know, security professionals or even volunteers. So things like, you know what? We'll do it this way. I'm going to go into a bunch of different practical situations for my listeners to know. And you can let me know what you think that they should know, even if they're not, they haven't been through a training, if they maybe just go to shul and they get a security briefing once a year or something like that. So let's first start with the personal. So I'm going to break it into personal, let's say shul and school safety, and then community safety. So let's start with personal. First of all, walking in the street. I like to walk in the street. I have my wireless headphones that I have right here. What do you think I could do about those, about walking in the street and just knowing my surroundings?
So, well, I think you already answered the question. I think, you know, knowing your surroundings is key. And I think there's a lot of, you know, great situational awareness courses, but I think that, you know, I think you have to find a balance, right? Because you don't want to get into a situation that people are not living their life and not, you know, walking around the street normally. But I think being aware of your surroundings is good, not just for anti-Semitism, but also that you don't get hit by a car, right? That you don't get hit by bicycle, or, you know, or bump into a stoplight. So, you know, I think as an individual, being conscious of your environment is key. But, you know, given the topic of today's conversation, if you are observant, or if you are, you know, and you know that there's a, or you're not observant, you know that there's a protest taking place or something happening on the street, you know, you see people that are shouting anti-Jewish or anti-Israeli things, you know, I would advise, you know, there's no need to engage. There's no need to make yourself more vulnerable than possible. And and I think some of the skirmishes we have seen was the result of, like, interactions. And, you know, you can see horrific things being said and being taken place. But if law enforcement is on site and if they have a permit, it's generally law enforcement's a responsibility to make sure it doesn't go out of hand. And, you know, and I'm not going to tell people what they should or shouldn't do. It's a free country. But we have seen that, you know, people that got into altercations or discussions, etc., or even, you know, when there were demonstrations that were not targeting Jews or Israel, we've seen that people that were identifiably Jewish, or buildings that were identifiably Jewish, were vandalized or harassed or assaulted. So, you know, being, I would then basically answer your point by saying, like, being aware of your surroundings goes one step beyond just looking that you don't hit something when you're walking. It also goes into knowing what is taking place in your surrounding, what is happening in your community, and use common sense. And but again, I'm not in the position I'm going to tell people what to do and what not to do. It's a free country. And, you know, if I see something happening that I strongly disagree with, I might speak up. So I don't, you know, want to tell people what to do, what not to do, but at least be conscious about it so that you can make that decision based on all pieces of information.
All right, so let's move on to shul safety, which is a primary point of action from your organization. So let's talk about first the importance of a security committee, and what should a security committee be doing? What's their role?
So I think, and like I said, I want to steer away from going into the operation, but one thing that I think is important to note is that there's great resources available for synagogues with regard to security. There's a number of key organizations. You have, of course, the Anti-Defamation League, which has a center on extremism that does a lot of research about threats, about white supremacy, other types of extremists, and they share that with Homeland Security. So for them to know that the ADL exists and this is part of their work is key. They should know that the CSS exists and that we have programs available for their community members to get involved with their security and that it is best practice. This is not something that we invented, it's something that's being done around the world. And I can, and I hope we get into that, I can give you a dozen of examples of how volunteers made a difference in protecting their community. So the knowing that the CSS is out there and that we have resources available for free, we're not a company, we're not for profit, and everything we offer is available for free for synagogues. So that's the second thing. And then there's also the Secure Community Network, or SCAN, which is an organization embedded in the Jewish Federation of North America that have a lot of resources available as well. That goes from, you know, assistance with applying for federal grants to do the kind of, you know, physical security upgrades at your synagogue that you might not have the resources for yourself, and the government has funds available for that. And SCAN, the Secure Community Network, can help apply for those grants. And there's a bunch of other things that they have available as well. So my answer would be, if you are, you know, involved with security at your synagogue, you know, yes, have a committee and go shop with us, with the CSS, go talk with ADL, go talk with the Secure Community Network, and try to find out what programs and training is available for you. Most of it is free, and use those resources to get the best security umbrella around your community that you possibly can. And obviously, you know, security doesn't need to mean not being welcoming. You know, our mission at CSS protect Jewish life and Jewish way of life, so we don't want to infringe upon that. But there's a lot of things you can do to make your community more secure without losing the inviting environment that makes your synagogue feel like, you know, the home to your community.
So I do want to bring that up because that was the next topic that I wanted to hit, is being secure versus being welcoming. How can you balance those two things, especially when you have guests that you haven't come, that are coming in that people don't know, so the CSS, the volunteers, the security that you may have hired, we don't know them. I'll tell you one quick story. This happened a number of years ago where a person was walking in front of my synagogue and was not dressed in, let's say, traditional Orthodox Jewish garb for Shabbos. And I happened to know this person, and he walked by me, and I exchanged pleasantries with him. I wasn't that close, and walked away and thought nothing of it. Later on, somebody from the security team came over to me and said, "Can you tell me about this guy? Because he wants to come in and we don't know him." So how, and I told him, and they let him in, everything was fine, and he wasn't insulted in any way. He got it. But not everybody is okay with that type of a greeting, let's say. So how do you balance, let's say, security versus being welcoming?
So, well, I think there's a few sub questions packed in your question. Like, one, I think that you don't need to have confrontation, you don't need to have escalation in order to be aware of what's taking place around your community. Like, there's not intrusive ways of assessing whether certain things are a threat or not. And that's something that we focus our training on. There's also something like, you know, that we have included in our curriculum, is something about, like, called unconscious bias. Like, you know, when you look at, you want to know if somebody belongs or doesn't belong in the synagogue, it shouldn't be based on, you know, prejudice. It shouldn't be based on someone's skin color, on someone's, you know, clothing, etc. I'm not saying that, you know, someone's clothing can have an impact on how that person will be assessed from a security point of view, but people should not be influenced by any kind of unconscious biases that they have. It's not good security. And I think you can balance it very well. You can have a situation where you have, the largest and most welcoming synagogues in the country have the most expansive and comprehensive security plans. So I think if you plan it well, and if you have the right training, and if you have the right fit for purpose programs and resources at your synagogue, I don't think it needs to come at the expense of being open and inviting. That said, and obviously, I'm being careful with the words that I choose because I don't want to get into the operational, but that said, we are living in a time when there is a threat. And it might not be a message that people want to hear, but if somebody tells me I want to, keep all the doors wide open and let everyone in without checking anyone, I'm not going to say that is smart from a security point of view. So some level of checking or some level of supervision is going, it's just good practice. But I think I would sort of turn it around. Like I would feel much more happy going to a synagogue if I knew that they take security seriously. So in that sense, I think creating a safe environment for people to come and pray and be part of a community, especially in the zeitgeist where we're living in right now, might help to that. But I don't think security needs to go hand in hand with escalation and tension and people feeling uncomfortable. I think it can be done very well together. And I think, the different kind of programs that we at the CSS have combined with the kind of support that Secure Community Network or in New York, the Community Security Initiative, this federation initiative that they offer, I think will enable an environment that can have both. So I think it's always going to be a balance, but I think it is very much possible to have a good security and a welcoming environment go hand in hand.
So I can go on and on about different shul security things. I want to do one more and then I want to move on to community safety. And then I want to get some examples from you of how CSS in action has actually worked. So last thing I want to ask about shuls is active shooter drills and attack drills. How often should shuls and synagogues and everywhere, and maybe schools also, run these drills?
Yeah, I'm not going to give sort of a specific number or anything like that. I also think there's certain things that we specialize in at CSS, and there are certain things that other organizations specialize in. But in general, I think training is good. I used to play soccer when I was a kid, and if I trained a lot, I would do better in the match. But but if I trained too much, I didn't want to go anymore, right? So I can't give you a hard number, but I do think that some sort of drills, exercises as a community, just like when you work in a building in a city in Manhattan and they do once so many times they do a fire drill or something like that, I think it just makes a lot of sense. But I can't give you a number, say, it also depends on the community, it depends on the type of building, it depends on the environment that they're located in. But I do think it is something that should be done, but I can't give you a number of this is how many times.
All right. So let's move on to the community safety, not just synagogues, not just schools, but obviously, yes, schools, but public parks, restaurants, anything that people should know about when they're out and about in public.
Well, I think the key message, and I think this goes for a lot of the questions that you've asked, and it is not something unique to CSS or to the Jewish community. But if you see something, say something, right? I think and that's maybe something that CSS promotes very much. It's about empowering the community to take some ownership over their own security. Don't think that there will always be somebody else. If you feel uncomfortable about something that you're seeing, if you, if you're at a playground and you don't feel comfortable about, a bag being left unattended or a group of people walking around or somebody behaving a certain way. And again, I'm looking at behaviors, not people of a certain background. And if you don't feel comfortable, then, think about, or if you feel not safe, also think about the broader community, think about the collective and report it. If you see an unattended bag or you see something that you think is concerned, maybe, alert local law enforcement or someone that's nearby or staff, if it is a place where there is staff, so that there's somebody that will look into it. Like don't ignore it. It's like, if you go through, I think even in the, most of the trains and if it's the Long Island Railroad or it's the, the Metro North or Amtrak, it includes signs, see something, say something. So I think, I would advise everyone that if they see something that they think is a cause of concern, and I would encourage members of the Jewish community to enroll in some of our programs at the CSS so they will learn better what are those things that they need to look out for around their their buildings and community centers. But if they see or notice something, report it, because you know that is how you stop and prevent attacks. And I'll give you an example. This is not pertaining to the Jewish community, but I think it's a very, very good example. In 2010, there was a car full of explosives that was parked on Times Square. I think it was around 200 kilos of explosives and 400 pounds. And this car was parked on Times Square, and the person left with the hazards lights flashing and the engine running. You know, Times Square is swarmed with police officers. The person who saw this car and thought it was suspicious was a local street stall vendor. I think it was a hot dog stall vendor who was there every day. And this person sees this car. He knows he's there every day. That doesn't usually happen. And he reports it to police, who then sees a lot of red flags. And I won't go into it. In our training, we talk about what makes, you know, a car suspicious. But police evacuated Times Square and managed to get rid of the car, and nobody got hurt. It would have been the biggest terrorist attack on New York soil since 9/11 on Times Square. And what prevented it? Someone selling hot dogs and someone selling shawarma who were paying attention and did exactly what I was just telling you to do. They said something. They didn't just look at it and think, oh, it's not my problem. No, they said something and they saved lives.
So that's a great lead into the next one. So that's a random street vendor. What about people that have been trained like by you guys? How have you had an impact on communities? If you want to give me examples, or if you want to give me a general sense of what you guys have done.
So I won't go into too many examples in the US because, you know, for the operational safety of our teams, but I will say that we've in dozens of cases, if not hundreds, shared information with law enforcement that helped with their investigation, and not just the local precinct, but also with Homeland Security and so forth. So obviously we've mitigated incidents in the US as well, but I'm not going to go further into the US because, you know, I don't want to disclose anything, but I'll go abroad and look at our sister organizations, like the partners of CSS operating in different countries, and give you some recent examples. Around 2 months ago, at a Jewish school in Marseille in France, parents of that school were trained by our sister organization in France to be volunteers, to be security volunteers. And they walked around the school as part of their routine, and they saw someone sitting in the car looking at the entrance, and they thought this person was suspicious. Now, a few years earlier, in a similar school in Toulouse, another city in France, Mohamed Merah, a radicalized person, I think of Algerian descent, attacked a Jewish school and killed several children, including a rabbi of the school. So it is not, they were not taking this seriously. They were very aware that there is a threat out there. So when they saw this person, they approached him, and this person got out of the car, pulled a knife, and ran into the next door kosher grocery store. And these volunteers tackled the person and held him down until law enforcement could arrest him without anyone getting hurt. These were parents, not private security, parents who were on site, who were paying attention. And they were doing this because when it's your kids inside and you know that the threat is real, you're gonna be paying attention. And they used their training to detect, and they used their training to stop this attack. And it could have been another tragedy, like what happened in Toulouse. I don't know if anyone knows about it. I think it was 2012. It was really horrific. Somebody came and killed little children at a school, you know, for the mere sole reason that they were Jewish. It's horrific. But in this case, these parents were trained. They were volunteers. They had their normal day jobs. But as trained volunteers, they were able to help save their children's lives. And I think it's a great example of why volunteer security matters and why it is important to empower community members to take part, because they're just going to be paying more attention when it's your children, right? And that's what happened here. So that's one example. I can give you another example of what happened in Antwerp in Belgium a year earlier in 2019. Someone came to the synagogue dressed as an Orthodox Jew, and the volunteer security guards, and I won't go into the details of how, but they knew that this person was not a member of the community because they were volunteers from that community. And they were able to stop this person that was dressed as an Orthodox Jew, but was in fact a radicalized individual who was carrying multiple concealed knives and was planning to perpetrate an attack. Again, these people were able to identify this person, even though he looked like a member of the community, because they knew their community.
Right.
So it's another example of how volunteers, trained members of the community, were able to stop an attack. But I can go all the way back to, I think it was the 1980s in Vienna, when there was a big terrorist attack planned with multiple gunmen. This was part of the time that the PLO and other groups were roaming around in Europe attacking, you know, Israeli and Jewish targets. And these people had planned for a very long time to perpetrate their attack. And when they got to the Grand Synagogue in Vienna, and they had done a lot of preparations, they were planning to hurt a lot of people, the volunteer on site saw them, locked the door, called police, and nobody got hurt. As simple as that. So I can give you many more examples. I think you get the gist.
Yeah.
Like, members of the community are able to detect things that people that are not members of the community cannot. And members of the community will care more because it's their friends and family inside. Those are the key separating factors. By adding volunteer security in addition to law enforcement and private security, if you can afford it, why volunteer security is so important.
I will tell you that in my neighborhood, about a month and a half ago from the time of this recording, we had an active shooter in our neighborhood, not targeting Jews, not targeting synagogues or schools. It was in a supermarket locally. And
what
was that?
I'm aware of that incident.
Yeah, you're aware of that incident. But the schools, the local schools, not only the Jewish ones, the public schools, the synagogues, everybody, even the library put out statements as to what they were doing. Everybody was on the same page. The entire community was on the same page. I don't think anybody outside of the supermarket where the shooting happened was ever in any danger. But it was helpful to know that the organizations that we rely on are aware and ready for any type of situation like this that should it come up. So being ready seems to be very helpful. Me as a parent, for sure, having children in the school at the time.
Yeah, I would add to that, though, that I do think you need to understand where your responsibility ends as an organization like ours. And I think an incident like that, you know, that it's law enforcement that should respond. I think in general, the default should always be to let law enforcement do its job. But we see ourselves as a force multiplier, not as a substitute. And I think we need something like this. I think it's important for us to also not fuel the rumor mill, because, you know, whenever an incident happens, there's a lot of stories that are disseminated, and getting accurate information, and, you know, is hard. And for law enforcement, it often makes it harder when there's a lot of rumors floating around that are not true. So the responsibility of an organization like ours that has close relations with law enforcement is also to let law enforcement do its job and to know what our role is and what our role is not. And in something like this, I think law enforcement was on top of it, and that's good. But yes, you know, an organization like ours, if it's in an area where there is where we have a presence, we will be aware. But we will, you know, we will always defer, you know, and let law enforcement do its job. But especially if it's not something that is targeting our community.
The CSS is a not-for-profit, so obviously you guys run on a model of donations. Where can people donate to you guys if they so choose?
You know, rather than people donate, we would like people to become part and volunteer and become members of our organization. But all the ways to get involved with CSS, either as a donor or as a volunteer, are available on our website. So I would recommend everyone that is interested in learning more to go to www.thecss.org to learn more about our programs, around our leadership and our philosophy. And obviously, there's an option there also to contribute. But, you know, that's not... I would say, like, I much rather have someone stepping up and saying, you know what, I'm going to help my community and I'm going to be a part of the solution and help protect my friends and family and get trained by CSS, than that they have someone, you know, make a contribution. It's also because the way we are being funded right now, you know, we have solid donors, people, philanthropic organizations, foundations that care about what we do. That doesn't mean that we don't welcome it. We can use everything. Our mission is daunting. So you know, we want people to get involved one way or another, and any way to get involved, all ways to get involved are on our website.
And of course, that website will be linked in our show notes. And in case you missed it, it's the CSS, not just CSS, it's the thecss.org. And a shul that wants to bring you guys in and conduct training, that's also available on your website?
Yeah, they should, you know, if, whether you're an individual or a member in, involved in the board or in another sort of leadership role in your community on a voluntary basis, on a professional basis, you know, we have a myriad of programs available. All our programs are available for free. And if you reach out on our website and you submit one of the inquiry forms for one of the programs, we will reach out, we'll have a longer conversation and talk about, you know, what makes most sense. And our goal is to protect and help secure as many Jewish institutions, events, people as possible. So our goal is always going to be to help you meet your needs.
And we'll let you plug your social medias if you'd like. I know the CSS has Facebook and Twitter. Is that right?
Yeah, so we have our CEO, Evan Bernstein, who I think it's, if you can add that to your to the information that you shared, it's @Bernstein_Evan. We have my Twitter handle, Richard Preem. And we have the CSS, which is @thecss.org. It's a Twitter handle. If you put in Community Security Service in Twitter, it will pop up. We are quite active, you know, in terms of giving updates on certain incidents and events happening, but all within, you know, we try not to be alarmist. Like we want to be prepared, and we want you to be prepared so that you can have the kind of peace of mind that you need when you go to synagogue, so you don't have to worry about security.
Richard, is there anything else you'd like to leave us with before we let you go?
If I could say anything, I think it's that, security is, just to be talking about security doesn't mean that we should not live our life freely and happily as we have been. I still think it's a very good place to be Jewish in the United States. As someone who grew up in Europe as the grandson of Holocaust survivors, I think I do have some perspective to say that I don't think the sky is falling. And I think if we as a community can step up and take a larger role in our own security, we can take the preventative and proactive steps now to make sure we can continue that way of life going forward.
Richard Preem, thank you so much for those hopeful words and all of your knowledge and information that you were able to give us today. We appreciate it, and we hope to hear great things from the CSS. And hopefully one day we won't need the CSS.
Thank you. Yes, it's quite a self-destructive goal, but I agree. If you're no longer necessary, that would make me much more happy than keeping my job.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Have a great day. My thanks to Richard Preem for educating us on safety measures this week. While this was clearly a long discussion, trust me when I say there is even more that Richard wasn't able to discuss on the show. But if you are interested in getting a wider education on CSS and what they do, I recommend that you volunteer for your local CSS or get your shul to get on board. Links to doing either of these will be available in our show notes. If you would like to hear the interview with Pastor Gilman Rose that was mentioned during this discussion, that's episode 38, Bridging Communities. Until next time, Kol Tov.
The Jewish Living Podcast is produced by Sreli Pikus. Our theme song is The Band by A.B. Rottenberg. Follow us on Facebook at The Jewish Living Podcast and on Twitter and Instagram at Jewish_living. You can also email the show at jewishlivingpodcast@gmail.com. The Jewish Living Podcast is recorded in conjunction with the Queens Jewish Link.